There's a new phrase that we're all going to have to add to our socioeconomic lexicon sooner, quite possibly rather than later. Actually, today, now that I think about it, climate refugees is the phrase of the day from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the third day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We've got, as we've all heard, political refugees. There are economic refugees as well. And now, for the first time in the United States, we have climate refugees. The first slice of taxpayer money being spent to move an entire community that lives right on the edge of where climate change hits reality. The community in question is down in South Louisiana. The story about it is in today's New York Times. Coral Davenport shared the byline on the piece. Coral, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Kai. It's great to be with you.
Tell me about the Île de Jean Charles, I guess is how you pronounce it.
Yes. So it is a tiny little sliver of land on the south coast of Louisiana. And this is sort of a part of the country, a part of the world that science shows us because of rising sea levels, because of climate change, within our lifetimes, it's probably not going to be inhabitable anymore.
And so the government has now, to the tune of $48 million, decided it is best to move the entire community. Who are we talking about here?
So, yes, the federal government has been looking for a while at ways to help cities and counties and different parts of the country prepare for rising sea levels and climate change and higher storm surges, generally by doing things like building dams and levees and sort of making communities more resilient. This is one place that they looked at and they said, there's no way to kind of batten down the hatches and prepare. This place is going under. Their daily lives are being affected by these rising sea levels. They're experiencing regular flooding so frequently that sometimes they'll miss many days of work because the roads are flooded. Kids can't get to school because the school bus can't come and pick them up. So this kind of flooding is a regular part of daily life.
So where are they going to go and who decides? And I mean, there are so many questions when you're taking a whole community and just lock, stock, and barrel moving it.
Yes. And as you said, it's a $48 million grant to move just 60 people,
yeah.
To give you a sense of how hard this is going to be. So the federal government sent the money to the state. The state is working with a local parish, that's the regional mm-hmm. government in Louisiana, to try to identify a community somewhere inland. First criteria, of course, is that it's safe and won't be yeah. flooded. But then it also has to be somewhere that they can afford to purchase with the grant and where the surrounding community would welcome them. So this is a big challenge right off the bat. How do you find a place to move an entire community of people?
Right. And there have to be jobs and schools and infrastructure and all of that.
Yes. And what's important about this story is that it's not isolated. This is a preview. This is a preview of the kind of movement that we are likely to see, not just in the U.S., but all around the world. That's something that demographers and climate scientists have looked at and said, this is the first trickle of movements of millions of people that we are likely to see around the world in the coming decades.
Does everybody on the island have to leave when the community packs up and goes, or do they have the option to stay?
They absolutely have the option to stay, and the government has worked is trying to make that point. This is not a forced relocation. I think a lot of the older people there say, you know, this is our ancestral land. This is our community. We don't trust the government. You know, and remember, of course, this is a Native American mm-hmm. Tribe. Their ancestors originally came there fleeing the Trail of Tears.
From Andrew Jackson's days. Yeah,
exactly. And so there's a lot of distrust of the government, a lot of deep, resonant distrust of, oh, okay, the federal government's going to come and relocate us to essentially a reservation. And so no one's forcing anyone to leave, but it could if folks do stay, you know, they have this, you know, emotional reaction to leaving. But the question is, does it become even more difficult and more unsafe?
The headline in the New York Times today is called Resettling the First American Climate Refugees. Coral Davenport had part of the byline. Campbell Robertson had the other one. Coral, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Kai. Great to be with you.
Wall Street was underwater all day today at varying depths. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the many ways this economy has changed in the past 8 or 10 years is this. Teenagers just aren't hanging around malls and buying new clothes like they used to. The Wall Street Journal reports the teen retailer Aeropostale is going to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the next couple of days and close more than 100 of its 800 stores, becoming yet another in the getting long line of mall-based retailers in some trouble. Our fast fashion correspondent Anna Euler has this one.
Malls might not be the same hangout they were 10 or 20 years ago, but they're still around, for now. With the news that yet another mall retail store will likely be filing for bankruptcy this week, is it finally time to call it for these retailers?
No, I don't think that's the case at all.
That's Ken Morris. He's a partner at Boston Retail Partners. He says Apple is the perfect example of a company that has a lot of success at its retail locations. If you go to an Apple store, they're still packed most of the time and packed with young people.
You know, 90% of all sales still happen in store. And the reality is that's going to continue to happen because people, you know, love that theater.
But there's no denying the numbers. Just in the last year and a half, mall staples like Wet Seal, Quiksilver, and PacSun have filed for bankruptcy. Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail. She says we've changed our spending habits.
The challenge or the quest for the mighty dollar, it's going into a lot of other places today. And I think that's the sort of big macro trend.
You've probably heard that people are spending their money on experiences nowadays. And it's not just young people not spending their money on outfits.
It's not just about stuff anymore. It's about being financially responsible. It's about spending on enjoyable things with my family and friends.
And then there's always buying stuff online. You can comparison shop before you step foot in a store. Or while you're there, you can see how much that same thing costs online. For those things you don't need to see before you buy, more and more people are getting them delivered. Just ask your Amazon Prime account. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One of the theories of how best to cut healthcare costs in this country goes like this. If consumers knew how much they would have to pay for various medical services, they would be savvier shoppers, which would ratchet up competition among doctors and hospitals, which would drive down their costs and our prices. So, employers and insurers have created some online tools to help people distinguish more costly providers from cheaper alternatives. But as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the Health Desk at WHYY, a new study out today raises some questions about whether those tools work as advertised.
Say you live in a place where an MRI costs anywhere from $400 to $4,000. In response, companies hire firms like Castlight and IBM's Truven Health Analytics to give that price information to their employees. Harvard's Michael Chernew and a team of researchers studied two large employers who fired up Truven's online pricing tool.
I think the tools themselves are functioning moderately well, but it is not as simple as transparency advocates would sometimes have us believe.
In the first 12 months, just 10% of workers used the service, and it looks like no one saved any money. Truven said it welcomes this research and the chance to work towards a system of value-based care. Yale's Zach Cooper says while health policy types remain bullish on the concept, this research shows if employers want workers to shop smarter, more is needed.
This is a signal to employers to go to their insurance companies and say we got to do better, that there are real savings out there to be had, that the system's incredibly inefficient.
To realize the potential here, Northwestern's Craig Garthwaite says he'd like insurers to tweak their policies. He suspects so few people shop for lower prices because plans lack the right financial incentives. Instead, insurers could limit what they're willing to pay for some procedures.
And if you want to go to a place that's more expensive than that, then that's on you. If you did that, then people would be more willing to shop based on price.
The challenge is that it's harder to figure out how to set prices and measure quality, but it may take that kind of heavy lift before smarter shopping is much more than the promise of better days ahead. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The least surprising news of this day by a long, long shot. is that Hamilton cleaned up when this year's Tony nominations were announced this morning, a record 16 of them. Interestingly, that's probably not going to make it harder to get tickets because it's already basically impossible to go see that show unless, as Ilya Marritz reminds us from WNYC, you know a guy.
Sam Rudy has a casual personal style, as if to say, who, me? I'm no big deal. Gray New Balance sneakers, cramped little office with piles of paper everywhere, even right under his feet.
This is the important stuff, the stuff that I have to step over. It means every time I have to step over it, I'm reminded it's not done.
But make no mistake, this modest man is a shrewd power broker. Look for the clues among the scattered documents. Here are two boxes wrapped in shiny paper. Could it be champagne?
A fruit basket. And I guess they sent these cookies too. Have one. Guys, come get a cookie.
Sam Rudy is the kind of man people send gifts to, because Sam Rudy is the press agent for Hamilton, a gatekeeper to the show everyone wishes they could say they've seen.
This is from somebody that we helped get hard to get house seats to Hamilton, sent a fruit basket. They're running the gamut between sweets and a healthy fruit basket here.
There are 1,319 seats in the Richard Rogers Theater. For every showing of Hamilton, only a small number are not sold to the general public. They're reserved for critics, celebrities, politicians, family members, professional colleagues, theater people. Rudy keeps their names in a green three-ring binder. Justice John Roberts, Justice Anthony Kennedy, Connie Chung.
So, Matt Lauer, four seats. We want Matt Lauer to come.
Rudy suggests we meet up a little later at Hamilton. A group of almost 600 high school kids is coming in from Bayshore, Long Island, for a matinee, and Rudy wants to make sure it all goes smoothly. An hour before showtime, there's this sense of anticipation on the street. Ashley Minear of Washington, D.C., is close to a meltdown.
I just saw Phyllis Sue walk into stage door, and it was, like, it was really incognito, but I saw her. Like, she was there. It was crazy and amazing.
Philippa Sue, that's Eliza, or Mrs. Hamilton. But where is Sam Rudy? Rudy's right-hand man, Shane Marshall Brown, appears.
Some days when you follow Sam Rudy, I will play the part as Sam Rudy. So
you're the understudy.
I'm the understudy today.
Brown does not offer an explanation. But a few hours later, I learn a controversy has erupted over a casting call for Hamilton, which specifically calls for, quote, non-white men and women. Social media goes into a frenzy. Rudy, meanwhile, was working with the show's producers to formulate a response. It says, basically, anyone can apply. This show has its reasons for casting minority actors. Deal with it. New York Magazine called the statement, quote, so effective, it's like a founding father himself wrote it. Rudy told me about this later with just a touch of pride.
I don't take credit for that. That was a team effort that I helped manage.
Putting out conflagrations, all in a day's work. So, maybe you're wondering, how do I impress Sam Rudy? How can I invent some reason for him to let me have tickets to Hamilton? Rudy says it really helps to be famous. Sorry. And even if you are famous, when you make a request, make sure to phrase it politely. In New York, I'm Ilya Marritz for Marketplace.
I'm totally going to call Sam Rudy, by the way. Coming up.
In my mind, I was going to save my family.
14 years old, all alone, and very afraid. Diane Guerrero from Orange is the New Black, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 140 points today, 0.75%, finished at 17,750. Everything in the red all day. The NASDAQ lost 54 points, 1.1%, 4763. The S&P 500 dipped 18 points, 0.8%, 2,063 there. Lower oil prices hit energy companies today. Chesapeake chopped off almost 12%. Chevron down 1.9%. Financial stocks faltered. J.P. Morgan Chase off 2%. Goldman Sachs dimmed 1.8% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell to 1.79%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Ticker symbol TASR reports profits tomorrow after the bell. TASR being Taser International, best known for its stun guns, yes, but also and increasingly for its fastest growing product, police body cameras. There's some whispering out there that profits are going to fall short of expectations, even as more and more cities sign up for those Taser cameras. From WHYY in Philadelphia, PA, Bobby Allen explains.
Last year, President Obama earmarked $75 million to help local agencies purchase body cameras. And that's a lucrative market. So far, Taser is dominating it. In at least two markets, L.A. and Philly, they've done it by skipping the usual bidding process and instead piggybacking off existing stun gun contracts. Critics say that gives them an unfair edge. Sitting in his office on the 31st floor of a building in Center City, Philadelphia, attorney Chris McCabe reads the wonky language of a memo prepared by city officials.
Currently, the city has no procurement vehicle for these specific goods and services, and a competitive bid for these services would be time prohibitive.
What that means is that the city hasn't opened up a formal bidding process for a $1.4 million body camera contract and thinks doing so would take too long. McCabe says that's unusual, and he should know. He negotiated city contracts for 13 years. He says the bidding process is there so that contractors win not based on who they know, but on who has the best price.
You have to protect the taxpayers from fraud, corruption, and favoritism, and that's done through a publicly transparent competitive bidding process.
Taser's executive VP of global sales, Josh Eisner, defends the company by saying, hey, it wasn't their choice.
To imply that we're trying to convince agencies not to go out to bid, that's their decision, and we're happy to compete in either scenario.
Taser is doing a good job from their company's perspective.
Mike Purdy's a veteran contract consultant in Seattle. He says those public bidding rules can be cumbersome to private companies trying to move fast. Using existing contracts to get around them, that's savvy business.
But yes, there is a clash with public procurement and transparency and openness and competition and things like that.
The folks really ticked off about Taser's edge? Other makers of body cameras. One such company is Georgia-based Utility. They've won contracts in Long Beach, San Antonio, and Colorado Springs through competitive bidding. CEO Bob McKeeman says the company's handicapped if cities make the deal behind closed doors.
If we don't get a chance to propose and we're not on the playing field, it's hard to win the game.
Taser's Eisner, meanwhile, wonders if the way government does business really leads to the best outcome. Does being the lowest bidder always mean you should win?
Would you feel comfortable sitting on an airplane where every single part of the plane was awarded to the lowest bidder? I wouldn't.
Philadelphia city officials seem to have heard the outcry. They now promise that the next batch they buy will come after competitive bidding. Their longstanding relationship with Taser, the city says that won't be factored in. In Philadelphia, I'm Bobby Allen for Marketplace.
One day, back in the spring of 2001, when she was 14 years old, Diane Guerrero came home from school and neither of her parents were there, as they always were when she got back from school. Guerrero, who now stars in Orange is the New Black and Jane the Virgin, was living near Boston, and her parents, undocumented migrants, had been detained by immigration. They would soon be deported back to Colombia. Guerrero, who was born here, stayed. She tells her story in a new memoir. It's called In the Country We Love. Diane, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You say early in this book that you don't remember a time when you didn't know your parents were in this country illegally, but you never really understood what it meant until you were like 7 and your parents were having a fight, right?
I mean, I always heard talk, right? My parents were constantly talking about what they were going to do, what their next step was, if they should go back, you know, what kind of opportunities do they have to get their green card or to achieve documentation. Until I was 7, they were having a huge fight over it. So I told my parents, you know, I was very dramatic as a kid. So I told them, I said, I'm calling the police. You know, if you don't stop fighting, I'm calling the police right now. And I got close to the phone. And then my mother said, if you call them, they'll arrest us all and you'll be left alone. And that's when I realized that things were really, really unstable. And part of the reason why they were fighting so much was because of this one thing.
Let me jump ahead a little bit. So after you come home that day from school, it becomes clear very quickly that your parents aren't coming back. They get processed through various detention centers and facilities. You wind up going to see your mother, and she says, I think it's through like that plexiglass with the phone thing. She says,
"Yeah." She says,
Diane, why don't you come back to Colombia with us, which is where your parents are going to get deported to, and you decide to stay. Why?
Yeah. Well, the reason I decided to stay, I just always had it clear in my mind what I wanted to do. I had a goal, and my mom was saying this to me, but in my head, I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I have everything here. This is where my opportunity is, and I have to continue with that. In my mind, I was going to save my family. In my mind, I couldn't go back because then I would lose out on all these opportunities that I was having here in the States. And those opportunities, I'm telling you, weren't easy to find either. I mean, I was in a very, you know, low income area in Boston. I had to go to public school, but I had applied to a pilot school, this performance arts high school. So I felt like that was a great opportunity. And I saw it as a sign that I could, so to speak, pull myself up from my own bootstraps and create something of myself despite my circumstances. And I will say that I was just afraid. I was afraid of not making it. I was afraid that, you know, we weren't going to have enough money there. And usually the opportunities in Colombia are slim if you don't have any money. I mean, that's just like the plain and simple of it. And so I didn't go.
You were, emotional scarring aside, you were physically safe. You were with a neighbor that your father had arranged. And then, I mean, you got moved around quite a bit, but you had a place to stay and to sleep. The question is, did anybody from the government, you were a minor, you're 14 years old. Did anybody from the government come and check on you after your parents were deported?
No, it was as if my family never existed. And as if I didn't exist, really. I don't know if it was just that they didn't care or they didn't. I mean, they must have known about me. I don't know. I don't know what happened, but no one came to check up. No one asked any questions. And I just sort of kind of went through life like this. And I didn't know what would happen to me if I made any noise. You know, I kind of took from my parents what they had done all these years was just to be quiet and to be under the radar and not to cause any commotion and to be law-abiding and good.
You do figure stuff out eventually. You figure out how to get out of high school. You figure out how to get into college and through it. You did wind up with just a mountain full of student debt, though. That to me was like, wow, she got all the way through this and now she's signing away all these loans.
Oh, yeah. No, I had no idea what I was doing, but it certainly caught up with me. I didn't realize how difficult it was going to be, and you know, the purpose of why I was there became secondary to all this stuff that I was dealing with. So it became really stressful, and so I sort of almost fell off the edge there.
And there was a crash, right? I mean, you went through a period where you were in rough shape.
Oh my gosh, yeah. You know, this whole time during high school, I thought that I had it together. I had a plan. I was going to make something of myself. I was going to make my parents proud. And, you know, I was flying blindly. And so all that came out in the form of depression once I couldn't hack it. And that's when I knew that I needed serious help.
Yeah. And you found the help and you eventually found your way to acting and theater and drama, and you get this audition for this show called Orange is the New Black. You get cast in it, and the best part of this book, honestly, is where you say, yeah, it was just a web series, so, you know, whatever.
Right? Yeah, I mean, at the time, no one knew what, you know, I mean, I knew Netflix, you know, I would order DVDs, and I wouldn't find them for weeks, you know, and I finally returned them without watching them. So it's so funny. And so I didn't understand what this streaming content was. And so I went for it and, you know, by golly, I got it.
Yes, you did.
And it made everything make sense. My struggle, my pain, my joy. And I know I have a long journey ahead. I know this isn't it. And this is just the beginning for me. So every day I'm learning.
You've seen her on Orange is the New Black, her new book. Her new memoir is called In the Country We Love, My Family Divided by Diane Guerrero. Diane, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, in which I might finally, at long last, get some cool dad points. Despite much ridicule, I think you all know I've made no secret of the fact that my usual mode of transportation on this earth is a minivan. Practical, if not the hippest thing you've ever seen. But now this. Google announced today it's going to build self-driving minivans. Come on, 100 of them. It's going to partner with Chrysler to do it. I am happy to be a test subject. I'm just saying. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks so much for listening to Marketplace. You hear me do the numbers every day, but we aim to bring you more than the numbers. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. We'd like you to help keep our numbers strong by making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace. And this month, your gift in any amount is going to be automatically doubled thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. So please donate today at marketplace.org. All right, so far today I've begged for Hamilton tickets and a self-driving minivan. Not bad. The Dow off 140 points today, 0.75%. The NASDAQ down 54 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 down 18 points, 0.8%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. I was just kidding. You know that, right?
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.